So good morning. Let's go ahead and get started. We'll start with our blessing. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher bachar banu mikol hamim v'na'atan lanu et torato. Baruch ata Adonai notein ha-Torah. Amen. Just a housekeeping thing. This will be our last class for 2014. I'll be leaving with Eileen on Monday morning for Israel. And then I'll be there for the rest of the month, and we'll be back in January.
Together?
For GWRP.
And a whole bunch of
other one people. So
how many, 15?
There's 14 of us, yeah. Oh, okay. So it should be really nice. So we'll be gone, and I'll be gone, and then I'm coming back on January 1st, so that I think the next Thursday is actually January 8th. So theme is Jewish women, Judaism, and the land of Israel. Yeah.
Same places,
same bat time, same bat channel. I'm sorry, it's from Batman I used to watch. They used to say, same bat time, same bat channel. Like, you miss Batman, okay. I'm too old, I guess. All right. So, Parsha Vayishlach. So what I'd like to do is, since we are coming to Hanukkah, I would like to also talk about the Parsha in the context of Hanukkah and the Parsha. So there'll be some overlap for some of the women who were at the Jewish women class. I hope that will be okay. Okay, it's very exciting. Okay, so this parshas are always read before in the Hanukkah season. We are in the month of Kislev, so we are coming to Hanukkah. And we know that even though Hanukkah starts on the 25th of Kislev, really at the end, Parsha Vayishlach is on page 171, that even though the holiday starts at the end of the month, that the entire month of Kislev is really considered to be the light, the spiritual light of Hanukkah. So we look at the parshas that come before Hanukkah to see what kind of messages are related to it as well. And specifically, we're going to take a look at the relationship between Jacob and Esau. So we know that in this week's Parsha that Jacob has left the house of Laban, has left the house of Laban, and he is going to encounter his brother Esau. But before that happens, he is engaged in what is described as a struggle. Okay, the challenge between Jacob and Esau. And we're going to turn now, even though I told you page 171, go ahead and turn to page 175, because we're going to look at the struggle between Jacob and Esau. It begins on verse 25. And so let's go ahead and read that. Mindy, would you like to read verse 25 for us?
Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. When he perceived that he could not overcome him, he struck the socket of his hip. So Jacob's hip socket was dislocated as he wrestled with him.
Okay, and then we'll stop there for now, and then we'll come back to the next part. So the word I want to focus on is the word that describes the wrestling that Jacob did. So it specifically says that Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with him, an ish. In the Hebrew it says ish. But we know, like all the commentators say, it wasn't just like some random person came up to Jacob and started wrestling him in the middle of the night, that this person was an angel in the form of a person. We've seen that before, that we know that when Abraham and Sarah had their guests, they were malachim, there were three angels that came in the form of, at that point, also men, travelers, desert wayfarers. They came in the form of people. But they were malachim, they were angels. So this too is understood to be an angel, and it's the angel of Esau. It's Esau's angel. And he is coming to struggle with Yaakov. So what's interesting is the word that is used for the struggle is really the word for wrestling there, is vayeavek. Vayeavek, and it's related to the word avak. And what does avak mean?
Dust.
Okay, so there's all sorts of beautiful interpretations. It means like that when people are wrestling together, they kick up dust. Okay, you kick up dust. People even say, well, they had a dust up. Okay, so what does it mean they had a dust up? They had like a skirmish, a little fight. Okay, so this idea of dust. So the question is, what does this mean, and what is the idea of this wrestling? This word, avek, is understood also to be that it could be also understood as being related to the word chibuk, that it has two of the three letters of chibuk, which means, what does chibuk mean? It means to hug. So you can understand why that might be related. So what's similar to hugging and wrestling?
Embrace.
You're embracing. Hey, if you're, this is not boxing, so it's very different. There's different ways to fight with someone. You can shoot them, you can, you know, do all sorts of whatever types of things. You can box them, you can do all sorts of things. But wrestling is a different kind of fighting because you are actually have your arms wrapped around them. It's very intimate. In fact, you kind of wonder. Okay, I remember like watching wrestling matches in high school because I was a pom-pom girl, and I'm like, seriously, this is a little weird. Okay, a little weird. Okay, so it's a little intimate. Okay, it's intimate, and so there is the questions like, are they hugging each other? And if you saw two people wrestling, you might not necessarily know is if this was in like an expression of affection or an expression of something else. I'm sorry? Like kids wrestling, you know, animals, little, even little animals, like little tiger babies, like wrestle with each other. So you don't know. So this idea of being in this wrestling, of this embrace, but that is a fight, that there is something that's going on. So we want to understand that. And so we want to understand what is the nature of the fight between Yaakov and Esav. What is the nature of that wrestling? So one of the things we want to try to appreciate is that what Esav represents and this dust up that comes to when they are engaged in this fight of what is really going on. So let's just back up a second and talk about, bless you, the idea of dust. So in Jewish law, there's another reference, there's two other references in Jewish law to dust of the word avak. Okay, the word avak, is anybody familiar with any other references when we hear the word avak? The dust of, this is what's called avak lashon hara, the dust of lashon hara, the dust of gossip. So the dust of gossip means it's not exactly gossip, but it has like a taste of it. There's like a sprinkling of something. So if I said so-and-so did such-and-such, and I use their name, and it's like totally something negative, that's called lashon hara gamur. That's straight 100% lashon hara. But there's ways of saying lashon hara that are, you're not even sure. In fact, you might even say, I'm not sure if this is lashon hara or not. And usually if somebody says that, when we say that, it means usually it is. But it may be like avak lashon hara. It's close to lashon hara. So something that's the avak of something means that it's just like a little bit of it, but we're not sure if it's the whole thing. And the truth is, that's when we get in the most trouble. We get in the most trouble with the dust of lashon hara, where it's close but not full scale. Most of us, I'm sure, would never engage in full scale lashon hara, but there might be some dust around. This is also used in the concept of having interest, charging interest, which we are not allowed to charge interest. It's a whole body of law we're not going to talk about at all, but there's something that's called avak rivas, which means like the dust of interest. And the example that was given, this was by Rabbi Shmuel Greenberg. Greenberg. That if someone says, I'll give you a case of soda, but you need to pay me back two cases of soda. That's called interest. But so nobody, of course, would do that, of course. But if someone says, I'll give you a can of soda, and like next time I'm in your store, a little, you know, discount on something would be nice. Or, you know, if you do me a favor, says, that's interest. That's called avak rivas. That is like, there's like a little something that you're adding in that you wouldn't say it's full scale, but there's a little something. It says, it's the dust that gets us in trouble, and it's the dust between Jacob and Esau. It says, that's the challenge of the Jewish people, is dealing with the dust of the world, with things that seem like they are okay, but are probably not okay, and that we are in kind of in an embrace with the world. It's not an attack with we're separated and we're trying to, one person's trying to do the other person in. It's really more of an example of there's some sort of an embrace and a closeness and intimacy, and in the process of that intimacy, we get blown off track over who we are, and we can end up getting really, truly pummeled, and we can get destroyed. So as the Jewish people, our challenge is, we actually do better when somebody is trying to outright harm us, and then we can fight, is different than if they embrace us. If they embrace us, then we're not quite sure what to make of it, and then we kind of get confused and we start not knowing who we are. This was the case for sure in the time of the Hanukkah story, because that's what the Greeks did, is they didn't want to kill us, they didn't want to do in and destroy us physically the way Haman did when he wanted to destroy all of the Jewish people. They wanted us to assimilate, dress like us, take our names, participate in our parties, come eat our food, go to our theaters, be with us, we embrace you. We embrace you, we like you. We even think you're smart, we think you're nice, we think you're wonderful, so come be Greek with us. That's what gets us, is the embrace that really turns into a wrestling match, because it can wound us and destroy us. Eileen.
I feel like assimilation is far more dangerous than the entire Arab nation. Because in Israel, they know who they are, and they have the pushback of, we must be strong against them. And here, my entire family has completely assimilated. They have no idea, except my father, no idea.
Who they are.
No idea. So that's, to me, far more dangerous, because they have become the enemy.
And it's hard because that where we become our own enemies because we're embraced with the Esav. It's like, are we kissing and hugging each other, or are we, what's happening? And we don't realize, and what is the nature of that is the dust. Because we're not too sure, because it looks like it should be okay, but it's not okay. And then we're not quite sure. And the other thing about dust is if you have dust in your eyes, what happens? You can't see. And it doesn't take too much dust. If you get like an eyelash in your eye, it's like, oh, you know, like, oh, I can't see. It says the dust in our eye that clouds our vision, we become very unsure of who we are. Susan.
Didn't the Greeks, they wanted to put the pig in the temple and worship the pig or whatever, you know, that was pretty blatantly, you should change.
That was to be not Jewish. Just don't be Jewish. Like, what's wrong with a pig? A pig is a perfectly good animal. Okay, you should do that. You can.
It's part of it.
It's like, it's, you know, you just let go of that. And they want us, what do they want us to let go of? They want to let go of Brit Milah, Rosh Chodesh, circumcision, Rosh Chodesh, Shabbos. Like, you don't have to do, why do you have to be so Jewish? You know, just be Greek with like a little Jewish flavor. You know, go out to, you know, the kosher style deli, that's fine. But don't say you have to have kosher food. Don't say you have to have Shabbos. Don't say you have to have Rosh Chodesh. Don't say you have to have Brit Milah. It's like, look what you're doing to your bodies. You know, like, the human body is so beautiful. It's like, we think the human body is beautiful too. But it's made for, to house the soul. That's what makes it so beautiful, and it's God's handiwork. Not that it's beautiful in and of itself. Rosh Chodesh, because it talks about newness. The idea of newness was not a Greek concept, because the Greek concept is the world was static. It always existed. So the idea of Rosh Chodesh was antithetical, and it talks, that kind of change was antithetical to what they believe. So no Rosh Chodesh, no Brit Milah, because Brit Milah also, aside from what they consider to be the destroying of the human body and wounding it and making it disfigured, is that you're saying that you can improve on what God created. It's like, you can't improve. In a way, it was a wonderful philosophical statement. What was created is good as it is, and it doesn't change. The whole purpose of Brit Milah is you need to change yourself during your life, and we're starting on the eighth day by changing your body to show you that you can improve, that everything can be improved upon. So that idea was counter to the Greek culture. So this idea of neshama, of soul, not part of it. So this whole thing, but on the outside, the Greek life was very compelling, and the Jews became very attached and embraced and absorbed with it until they didn't know who they were. So it also didn't help, you know, with Jacob and Esau, they were twins. So if somebody is your brother, then it's really hard to say, oh, that there needs to be some sort of a separation. So interestingly, before Jacob even has this struggle with Esau. He says to God, if you go back to page 173, verse 12. So let's take a look at that. Vera, would you like to read verse 12, please?
Rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and strike me down, mother and children.
Okay. Bless you. So two things to notice here. One is that he says that he does have fear of Esau, and he's asking to be rescued. But the way he describes it, now remember, it's not like none of us know who Esau is, and especially since he's talking to God, and God certainly knows who Esau is, but he says very specifically that he is afraid of him, and he says, to rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. Okay, the hand of my brother, of what I need to be rescued from Esau, regardless of which persona he appears in. He may appear as my brother and want to just kind of take me in and I will assimilate and get attached to him and lose my identity and be destroyed that way. Or he may be the hand of Esau, and remember the last time we met Esau, he did want to kill Jacob, not assimilate with him. He wanted to kill him, and that's why Jacob fled their house to begin with. So he says, the Jewish people have two challenges, those who want to kill us and those who want to love us to death. Okay, so one is, as your brother, we're all brothers. Why can't you just be with us? Why do you have to be so provincial? Why do you have to be so exclusive? Why do you have to be so, you know, set apart? So we have the brother challenge and we have the destroyer challenge. We see the two holidays that the Jewish people celebrate that are where we celebrate the miracles that were done for our ancestors are Hanukkah and Purim. And they represent exactly those two struggles. Purim was the holiday of we are going to destroy you and kill you. And Hanukkah is we just want to be your brothers. And it says both of those were interestingly descendants of Esau. So we know Esau's one of his grandchild was Amalek, the Amalekites, and Haman was an Amalekite. And Esau is called Edom for being red, and it really represents Rome, but the precursor of Rome was Greece. Just the idea of, no, we want to love you, and I'm your brother, and I want to destroy you spiritually. So both of those are the challenges of the Jewish people, and it seems throughout history, those have been the two challenges that the Jewish people face. And what happens is that the dust comes up and we get confused and we end up, and it says that Jacob is wounded by this, that he wounds him, and it says in the sciatic nerve, which is why we do not eat the sciatic nerve in the back, the rear part of an animal, unless you have a butcher that can take that nerve out, which is, I guess, an expensive and messy process, can't be done so easily, so we just don't eat the hind quarter of the animal, and it specifically says that after Jacob wrestles with him, so that because when he is wounded, that there was an impact, all this. There was a question, Paulette.
But Purim too, didn't they want people, the Jews, to become like them and bow down like the others would?
That was just a power play. That wasn't like become like us. That was initially be like us and bow down. And the Jews did bow down because there was only one person who didn't. Mordecai was the only person who didn't. The Jews had also assimilated into Persia. It says that was our sin. It says Haman saved us. By decreeing death on us, that got everybody's attention because the Jews had very much assimilated into the Persian Empire. It says that there's a people that scattered throughout the land. Persia was beautiful. The Jewish people thrived there. Even after the Queen Esther and after Haman was gone and the Jewish people were saved and the Jews were to go back to the land of Israel to rebuild the temple, the only people who went were the poor people who didn't have it so good in Persia, might as well go there. So it was only like I think 10%. It was a very, very small number who even went back because life in Persia was beautiful. It was a wealthy, it was the premier country. The Jewish people are always in the countries that are flourishing the most. Of course, the Jewish people help those countries flourish the most, but those are the places that then we are engaged with whatever the struggle is going to be.
So that brings up a question. Persia is now Iran. So there's probably a lot of Iranians that are...
For sure. Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are a lot of Persians who are of Jewish descent.
They wouldn't even know it.
No, and until very recently, Queen Esther's tomb was a holy place, one of like their historical landmarks. But then they decided that they read the Megillah and that the Jewish people killed Persians in defense, self-defense, who came to kill them. And they said that the Jews committed a Holocaust under Queen Esther and Mordecai, and so they destroyed the tomb. Or they closed it off and took it off their list or whatever. It may also be there. There's a lot of things there. There's a lot of Jewish history. That's where we were. That's where we were living for a good long time. Okay. All right. So this is the challenge of the Jewish people. When we celebrate Hanukkah, we are celebrating our ability to prevail over the assimilation. So what was challenging is that what started out as an assimilation challenge actually became an actual physical battle, because it did. The Hashmonaim, the Maccabees, went to war to stand up and fight, because our spiritual lives were in such danger that it was going to be the end of the Jewish people. So the idea that they had that kind of a conflict and that we prevailed, then we go back and we celebrate Hanukkah, and we celebrate Hanukkah very interestingly. Even though the celebration is a rededication of the Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple, it is not really a synagogue holiday. I mean, people go to the synagogue, like just the people who normally go, it's regular, but the celebration of Hanukkah is in the home. It's in the home, because it was the home that was being threatened. So we talked about yesterday, actually, that's very interesting. On Purim, we have a Megillah that tells the entire story of the whole Purim experience. And everybody has to hear every single word of the Megillah more closely than the Torah. If there is noise while the Megillah is being read, the reader is supposed to stop. Even though I know all of you are saying, not at my synagogue, they don't stop. It's like a total... They're supposed to stop. There's supposed to be no talking during the Megillah reading. You must hear every single word. And you don't hear the Megillah just once. You hear it in the evening, and then a complete repetition of it again in the morning. So we hear it twice, completely through every single word of the story, and we spend a lot of time studying that. Hanukkah, the book of the Maccabees, isn't part of our Tanakh. It's not even part of our Bible. I've never even read it. And guess what? And at some level we say, who cares? It's not like we don't really care. We care about the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, Judah Maccabee, his brothers, his father, etc. But that wasn't the point of the whole situation. That was a family-by-family decision. Are you going to be a Hellenist, or are you going to be Jewish? What's it going to be? And everybody had to make their determination on their family and themselves. Are you assimilating? Are you with me? Or are you against me? That was the question. And that was a person-by-person, house-by-house decision. Are you going to be a man that's going to try to undo your circumcision so you can go be nude in the gymnasium that they built next to the temple? Is that what you're going to do? Are you going to be doing like the Greek thing, going to the Greek festivals? Or are you going to shul? Like, what's it going to be? And you can't do both. I remember Rabbi Torsh used to say, a person who sits on the fence gets a sore tush. Okay? It's like, one or the other. Mi chamocha ba'elim Adonai, who is like you, God? That phrase which we sing is, the acronym is Maccabee. Mi chamocha ba'elim Adonai. It's like the Maccabees is, are you with me or are you not with me? So that was the decision that had to be made. Are you doing Shabbos or are you going off to the theater? You having pig or are you having kosher? Decide. And each family had to decide, so that the celebration of Hanukkah is for the win of the Jewish home, of the Jewish home being rededicated. We rededicate the Jewish home, and that's why we celebrate the Hanukkah at home. And even ideally, and the way they do it in Israel, and it's so beautiful, I've actually never seen anyone do it here. I would be nervous, I have to say, to do it here, is people celebrate. Many of you, if you've been to Israel, you will have seen or will see that the menorah is placed outside. It is outside, and it's not outside in the front yard. It is right at the doorway. So as you face your door, so I'm just going to do it opposite. As you face your doorway, your mezuzah is on your right-hand side, and your menorah is on the left-hand side. It says, you're facing me outside.
We're outside.
You're outside facing your door. Just pretend I'm your door. Pretend I'm your door.
Okay, so I'm outside.
Looking at, you're coming up to your door, and on this, your right-hand side is the mezuzah, and the left-hand side is the menorah. Okay? And no, they don't blow out, because they have what looks like an aquarium type thing, and they put the menorah in, and people use oil rather than candles. And it lasts a long time, and it's very beautiful. People sit outside, and they watch their menorahs burn, because you're supposed to go out. You are publicizing the miracle that this home is dedicated to holiness. This is what's called a Beit HaMikdash. This is a house of holiness, and the place where it has to be, that holiness is protected, is at the door of the house, because the door determines what's coming into the house and what's not. Don't you remember, like, Leave It to Beaver, whatever, like, whatever, Mrs. Cleaver, he would come home, like, with, I don't know, some little animal. She goes, you're not bringing that in here. You know, Eddie Haskell would, like, whatever, try to get him to bring it in. But it's like, you're not bringing that in here. It says, the doorway of the house is what's coming into this place of Kedusha. Is this a place of Kedusha? Or is this a place of Hellenization? Is this a place of assimilation? Or is this a place of sanctity? And don't try to cut it both ways. It doesn't work. It's a wrestling match, and in the end, one has to prevail over the other. It can't be both. It can't be both.
Pam. I just think, you know how we all feel so safe. I guess I shouldn't speak for everyone, but generally we all feel so safe. We're in the United States, and the Jews are so safe. That's a perfect example of, you even said it, I'm not so sure I would do this. You know, I would not, I have never even put my menorah in my window.
So a lot of people, yeah.
And so I do think that for each one of us, we should ask ourselves that question. You know, it's like that cartoon, like in France, oh, the Jews are fine in Paris. And you see the guy with the ski pot under, you know, in his pocket, and
yeah,
his star underneath his
right
suit. I mean, if you're not able to do that, then you aren't.
You aren't free. So, and the truth is, halacha provides for that. If you don't feel safe, you don't put it outside, you can put it in your window. And if you don't feel even safe to put it in your window, you put it on your dining room table. So halacha provides for other ways, but this is the question we have to ask. There's another factor, too, which is my oil menorah is sterling silver, and I'm not going to leave that outside. I'm not going to leave that outside just like, and leave that there. So I would have to sit with it the whole time and wait. And Denver in the winter sometimes is not exactly so convenient to do that. So there's many reasons. But the idea of what is it we're saying, that we're saying about our home, is like, this place is dedicated to holiness, and it's the home that is the center and the strength of the Jewish people. The synagogues are great. Organizations are great. Federation is great. Whatever. ADL is great. All these different things are great. They will not ever save the Jewish people. There's only one thing that saves the Jewish people, and that is the Jewish home. And the Jewish home is the Jewish woman. So the Jewish woman is what, that is the strength of the Jewish people, and that is the person who is in charge of the holiness. We're called the gatekeepers. We are the gatekeepers. What comes through that door, that's us. We're supposed to determine that. Yes?
I would just also recommend, I mean, the first year I was so excited to put my menorah, and I put it in the window sill. It worked until the last day, the last night.
Oh, yes.
It shattered the window.
Shattered the window, the heat.
So winter, it's very cold, and they do put out heat. So
yes.
I now put it in the window, back.
Back a little. Yes, not, yes. Be very careful. Also be careful of drapery, hair, curtains, lots of things. Just because we're holy doesn't necessarily mean we're too smart. So it's like you have to just think. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard. I burned my, singed my hair 1 year as a child. Petty.
So are we exactly where we were back then? Now?
It's looking very similar to me. I mean, it's, you know, we have to ask ourselves the question. And that's why I think it's so interesting that Hanukkah is widely celebrated by Jews of all stripes. But the truth is the holiday is a anti-assimilationist holiday. It is a reclaim your heritage and go toward the path of holiness. It's saying, this is what I want. This is what I'm dedicated to. Chanukat HaBayit. Chanukah means to dedicate oneself. I'm dedicated to this. And it may be that I'm working on my dedication, and all of us are on, you know, the ladder of trying to improve and increase our dedication, but at least making the statement of having your menorah in your home says, this is where I want to be. These are my aspirations. So it's interesting. If you take your menorah to a Chanukah party at your synagogue and you light there, it doesn't count. It doesn't count. You have to light it at home. You must light your menorah at home. That's the place. It's not a synagogue holiday. So everyone's getting together, and your synagogue is having like a big Hanukkah party. Everyone bring your menorahs. We're going to all light together. That's very fun and festive, but it doesn't count. So when you go home that night, relight your menorah in your house. That is the mitzvah, not in the synagogue.
So what if I'm going to be on a plane?
You cannot light on a plane. Seriously. No, we did that last year. We had to miss a night of Hanukkah because we were traveling and we missed it. So you just make up for it when you get there, when you get to wherever you're going. Whatever home
you're
in. Yes, in your hotel, and if in Israel, they have lightings in the lobby, and so it's beautiful to see people gather together, and that's for safety. They have to do that. But you are living at the hotel, so where you're sleeping is called where you're living. That's the place where you light the menorah. What was that? Where? That's what I'm saying. In Israel, in the lobby, they do it. So you'll have to figure that out. I'm not sure. We'll find out what the halachas are for you. Let's find out. I don't know. So this whole idea is it's on the opening of the house. We are protecting. We're saying, I'm in charge here. I'm saying this house is dedicated to holiness. Now, Hanukkah is also related to the word chinuch, which means education. And education means you can only be dedicated to something that you are educated about. If you don't know what you're doing, then how are you going to know what that dedication means? But education leads to dedication, and if you want to dedicate yourself to something, it leads to becoming educated. So it's a good time to dedicate our homes to ourselves and say, what can I do to learn more about how to make my home a holier place, to make it pure? So I'd share the example that we were having Rabbi Schwab from Beis Yaakov over at our house. He was going to do, I don't remember, he was doing a program or something, and so before he came, he's the head of the Beis Yaakov school. He's the son of a very, very famous Rabbi Schwab, very famous rabbi. So, and he kind of looks like Santa Claus. I mean, he's very big and, very smiley, but very big. And kids have asked him if he was Santa Claus. You know, white beard, the whole thing, white hair. Anyway, he's coming to my house. So I'm looking at my house like, so what's the first thing I'm going to do? I'm making sure that nothing that's going to embarrass me is out. And I see, so at the time, Mademoiselle magazine or something, I'm like, I think I'll put that under the stack of Jewish newses, It's like, I'll put that away. What else should I put away? And I went around my house looking like, what doesn't really speak to a holy place here? And I went through and I just put stuff away. And you can say, that is so hypocritical. It's like, it's interesting. After he came, I decided if I wouldn't put it out for him, why am I putting it out for me? Am I any less holy than Rabbi Schwab? We don't have any different criteria for rabbis and regular people. We're all the same. I was like, put it away. I thought, why am I having this for myself? Get rid of it. So it's very interesting. I have to also tell you another story. When our son was at yeshiva, after he graduated high school, he used to be, I would say, kind of a wannabe sports fan. He wasn't really such a big sports fan. He wore the sports t-shirts, and his room downstairs had posters of all the different sports people, whatever. He collected cards. I don't know. But he was so into it. But he was into it enough. Before he came home from yeshiva, the first year, he called us up. He said, I want you to take all the posters down out of my room. I said, what do you mean? He said, to all the sports, just take them down. I said, how come? He goes, those are not people I aspire to be like. I said, do you want me to keep them? He goes, no, throw them away. I said, are you sure? I mean, it's not like I'm like, I couldn't care one whit about sports. I know nothing about it. So he said, throw it away. So I said, okay. So we took them all down, rolled them all up, threw them away. He says, those are the people that you aspire to be like? The people you look at and you bring into your bedroom, those are the people you're surrounding yourself with, your intimate space. Those give us messages. That's a lot of dust in your eyes about who it is you are and what you want to be. It says, get rid of it. So it got rid of it. It was very interesting. So then I thought, okay. What's there now? He has a picture of his family. There's a picture of the Israel Declaration of Independence. There's a beautiful art piece that has a Psalm of Tehillim, psalms that are beautifully, artistically decorated. Of course, he's also a married man with three children, so it was going to have to get upgraded to a grown-up room anyway. But this was when he was 19. He's like, take it out, take it out. I don't want that there. So the question is, what are we bringing in? What are we looking at? What are we influencing ourselves with? What kind of dust is in our house? So I have to tell you, I like domestic chores, and there's only one chore I don't like. Dusting. But I have to say that after I heard this class from Rabbi Shmuel Greenberg, I'm like, I think I have a new appreciation for dust, dusting as a task. Because what is it about dusting? Why don't I like it? It's everywhere and it keeps coming back. Okay? And it doesn't matter. You know, dishes only get dirty if you use them, right? Okay? The bathtub only gets dirty if you take a bath. Some things only happen if in the process of use they get schmutzed up. But dust settles everywhere. And one has to just keep at it, which just seems like so boring and annoying. But the question is, I thought, oh, this is very interesting, because that's really the truth, is being in our society, being in our communities, we interact with a lot of different people, the dust is going to get in our eyes. The dust is going to come just through the process of living in the world. If you are at the mall, if you're getting ads, if you're reading the paper, if you're listening to the radio, if you're talking to friends, if you're going out, dust, 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 dust. So I thought, great, this is going to be my Hanukkah self-improvement plan. First of all, I'm going to actually literally dust my house. And then think of that dusting all the time. Of this requires a constant approach, a constant effort to monitor the dust that is in our homes, to monitor the dust that gets on us. And it's interesting, things also get dustier when they're not moving around. I used to have a black piano, which I sold after I realized I wasn't playing it, and the only thing I was using it for was as a barometer of how dusty my house was. Okay, it's dusty. Okay, I don't need that kind of aggravation, so I sold it. Okay, so, yeah, it was a black ebony. I was like, what do I need this for? So, but things that move around, you kind of shake off the dust. It's like you have to keep moving. You have to keep in the action of rededicating yourself, re-educating yourself, moving, moving, moving to keep the dust from settling on us and keep that dust out. So this idea of how to get rid of the dust is part of the idea of this using the word dust for the type of struggle that was going on between Jacob and Esau. Because there were other words for fighting. There are other words that could have been used to describe fighting. It didn't have to be about dust. After this wrestling match, it's very interesting what Jacob says to the angel, and that is, and we'll continue now in verse 27 on page 177. And Susan, would you like to read verse 27 through, yeah, verse 27.
Schiff.
Susan Schiff, yes. I just going to call you Schiff.
Yeah. And he said, let me go, for dawn has broken. And he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me.
Ah, okay. And then continue verse 28, Peggy.
He said to him, what is your name? He replied, Jacob.
Okay, and then verse 29, Jan.
He said, no longer will it be said that your name is Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with the divine and with man and have overcome.
Okay, great. So what's really interesting is that after this wrestling match, the angel then says, let me go, for dawn has broken. What does that mean? It's like, okay, the wrestling match is over. Dawn has broken. It's morning time.
It's change.
So he was a dark angel because he's actually the angel of Esav. But when dawn comes, this is considered to be a hint to the future. So it's like when dawn comes, we always talk about the dawn of redemption. It's that in the end, Jacob will prevail. This wrestling match that's going on for all of Jewish history, in the end, Jacob will prevail, and Esau will not be successful. Also, when it says, for dawn has broken, that the angel has to go back to report to God. Like, how did you do? Because angels have jobs to do. What was Esau's angel's job? It was to wrestle with Jacob. And what was the angel's truest desire? The truest desire was for Jacob to overcome him. The angel was there as a test. The angel is there as a test. As I'm going to struggle with you. It's like if somebody is learning how to wrestle, and they do that, the wrestling matches. So before they have the wrestling match, what do? In a school, the team divides up, and they wrestle each other. so that they learn how to wrestle. So, but in the end, the goal isn't really to kill your opponent. The goal is to strengthen yourself to win. It says, in the end, the Jewish people will prevail. And in fact, the angel of Esav, that's its goal is in the end for us to prevail. And it's going to go at dawn. It says, because at dawn, all the malachim, all of the angels come, and they do what's called singing shira to God, which means that they sing God's praises. And what is the praise is, your children, Israel, prevailed. I was not successful, and in fact, that was my job, was to not be successful, to give them a good fight, but not to be successful in the end. And at the time of dawn, the time of the redemption, at the end of time, end of Jewish history, the Jewish people, Israel will prevail. So that is one of the reasons why Jacob says to the angel, bless me. That's not your normal thing that you say at the end of a wrestling match. Oh, before you go, can you give me a blessing? So say, he's bless me. Says, what did he want the blessing to say? Is bless me and say that I am the one who deserves the blessings that Father gave me. And he responds by saying, and he does bless him. And he says, no longer will it be said that your name is Jacob, but Yisrael, for you have striven with the divine and with man, and you have overcome. You are the one, you have the Bechor, you have the firstborn rights, you are the one who has the blessing. I concede. Okay, so that's the blessing, and that is Esav's job, the angel of Esav's job all along, is to enable Jacob to prevail at the end.
What was the name change? The difference in the two names?
Jacob and Yisrael?
Now, what's the difference between Yaakov and Yisrael?
Great. So Yaakov, interestingly, unlike Abraham, who goes from Avram to Avraham, and we are never supposed to call him Avram again. His is a change that is forever change. Yaakov and Yisrael, we refer to him back and forth all the time. Yaakov, which means from the word heel, is considered Jacob's name for him as the earthly in his normal life. Yisrael is the name that we use when we talk about him, Jacob in his prophetic state, Israel, and at his most elevated state. So we call ourselves Beit Yaakov, the house of Jacob, or Bnei Yisrael, the children of Israel. So both of those names. So it has to do, Yisrael, it's an acronym for all sorts of words. I'm sorry?
Struggle with God.
It means to struggle with God, but it's also Yashar El, one who is straight with God. So it's also related to the idea of being straight and on track. There's lots of beautiful. It also is an acronym for the words that say there are 600,000 words in the Torah. Yeshishim ribu otiot le Torah.
There's
letters. I'm sorry, 600. I'm sorry, I meant letters. There's 600,000 letters in the Torah. Is also the acronym for Yisrael. There's a lot of different things that Yisrael signifies. What's interesting is before Jacob meets Esau, he has a strategy for what he's going to do. I had always understood it one way, and from this shiur from Rabbi Greenberg, I learned something totally different, which is so beautiful and so appropriate for us as Jewish women, and so appropriate before Hanukkah as well. When he knows that he is going to be meeting Esau, not as Esau's angel, but Esau the man, he does something with he has like a three-prong strategy. The first prong is he's going to send a gift. He's going to send a gift to Esau to try to appease him. He's also going to plan a military strategy so that he can fight if he has to. And the third thing is he's going to pray. So those are considered the three strategies of the Jewish people. Appeasement, if that doesn't work, be prepared for war, and also pray. So that's our three-pronged strategy. What I also never understood is that he does something with his family. Esau's coming with 400 armed men. What would you do with your wives and children if 400 armed men were coming toward you?
Hide them.
He does not hide his family. In fact, he does the exact opposite. So let's take a look and see what he does. Back on page 177, we're going to look at verse 1 and 2. So let's take a look at verse 1 and 2. And Patricia, I think you were next.
Jacob raised his eyes and saw, behold, Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two handmaids.
Go ahead to the next sentence, too, as well.
He put the handmaids and their children first, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last.
Okay. Then he himself, Jacob, goes in front, and he bows earthward 7 times. Esau runs towards him, and interestingly, it says that he embraces him or he kisses him. If you look in the Hebrew, on the bottom of page 176, you'll see that one of the second word from the left at the bottom, you'll see it has little dots above all the letters. Just take it, even if you don't read the Hebrew, just look at that word. You can see it looks really weird. So there's a question about how he kissed him, if it was a biting kind of a kiss or if it was a kiss-kiss. Are those teeth marks or is this a kiss-kiss? It's a little reminiscent of the wrestling that he had with Esau's angel. Is this an embrace or is this I'm trying to overwhelm you? That's when it gets tricky. You don't know exactly what it... I'm sorry?
What's the point of those little,
dots? That's what we're saying. Those are the question. Those dots are a signal. Were they like the bite marks of Esau trying, it says like tried to bite Yaakov's neck and to kill him even while he was embracing him? Or was it a true kiss of brotherhood? With Esau, you never know. That's what's tricky is with it's a brother and someone embracing you, you don't really know what it's going to be.
Are they in the Torah?
They are in the Torah. They are in the Torah as well. So there's no vowels in the Torah. There's no punctuation in the Torah. But those dots are in the Torah scroll.
Wow. What does Nishika mean?
It means kiss.
It means kiss.
Mm-hmm. Nishika, a kiss. That's the question. What kind of kiss was it exactly? But let's go back and look at what he does here. Instead of hiding his children and his wives, he puts them out. Here's Esau with his 400 men. And then here's Jacob with his 4 wives and his 11 children. Rachel is pregnant with Benjamin, so Benjamin is not born yet. And these boys, I don't know, ranging in age from 20 to whatever, down to 2 or however old they are. Okay, Esau, here's what you got, and here's what I got. It's like, what is that? It says, it's his family. What's the strength of Yaakov? His message to Esau is, you may have armed men. You may be really smart. You may be really clever. You may be really powerful. But I've got my family. And the family is the source of my strength. And these little people here, these little, you know, Joseph and Naphtali and Dan and Gad and Asher, they're going to be a nation. And that's going to be the nation of the Jewish people. The Jewish people are no more than the people from that came from that family. Few other people who have converted and joined in, but basically we're a family. It says the family is the source of strength of the Jewish people. That's where our efforts are supposed to go into our family. And he doesn't hide them, he displays them. And he shows that this is who I've got. And before he meets Esau, he has a prayer that he says to God of what he's when he said that he was concerned about Esau. He's concerned about the impact that Esau's going to have on the family. So go back again to page 173. So I'll just read this here for us. Verse 12, rescue me again. This is, we're saying the same verse. Rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him lest he come and strike me down, mother on the children. So in the Hebrew, it's aim al habanim, mother on the children, meaning the mother-child relationship. I'm afraid, not that he's going to kill me. It doesn't say the word harog. It doesn't talk about killing. He's going to harm the family structure, and that is going to be what's going to undo me. That the Jewish home, the Jewish family is going to be somehow messed up, and that is going to be, that's what I'm concerned about. I'm not concerned about a fight. A fight, I can defend myself physically. I'm worried about what's going to be the internal impact on my family. So that's his prayer. That's the prayer he makes to God. And his response is specifically to focus on what his strength is, which is his family. And we understand that Esau understands that. Because if you look at, go back now to page 177, verse 4, Esau runs towards him, embraces him, falls upon his neck, kissing him, they weep, etc. And then to the top of page 179, Esau raises his eyes, and what is it that he sees? He doesn't see any of Jacob's armed people, any of his servants, or anything else. He sees the thing that counts. He sees the women and children, and he says, who are these to you? And Yaakov answers, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. He says, this is what I have. This is my wealth. The wealth of the Jewish people is the wealth of the Jewish family. When we talk about Hanukkah, it says, this is the Beit HaMikdash that we talk about dedicating and devoting ourselves to. The Beit HaMikdash that was the temple is a secondary expression of the Beit HaMikdash that is our actual home. We're going to take another look at, just to conclude at the very end, the Haftorah for Parsha Vayishlach is on page 1141. And on page 1141, we see the, excuse me, the prophetic, from the prophet Ovadia. And it talks about the future of what's going to be with Esau and with Yaakov. And I think we'll do it here is, actually turn to page 1142. Verse 17, and just in the English, and you'll listen for a word that occurs most frequently. But on Mount Zion there shall be a remnant, and it shall become holy, and the house of Jacob will inherit its inheritors. The house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau like straw. They will kindle among them and consume them. There will be no survivor in the house of Esau, for Hashem has spoken. What was the word that kept repeating itself?
House.
House of Jacob. House of Jacob. House of Joseph. House of Esau. It says, house of Esau is called a house of straw. Remember the three little pigs? What happens to the house of straw? The house of straw. In this case, it's going to burn because it says the house of Jacob, we have a flame and a fire. A flame and a fire. And it says it's going to be eaten, it's going to be consumed. It says Jacob, Esau's house was a house of no kedusha, no holiness. It says his children, his whole family are all illegitimate children that are born out of incestuous relationships where the father-in-law has relations with his daughter-in-law and they have a child and then the child is this person and this person is married to the, has relations with the brother and with that one. It's like the whole house is like, ugh. So it's like there's no kedusha, there's no holiness in this place. It may look big, but it's just going to evaporate. It's going to just burn up. The house of Jacob, the house of Joseph. So we have Beit Yaakov. When I said before that Rabbi Schwab had come over and that he is the principal of Beit Yaakov. Why is Beit Yaakov called Beit Yaakov? The house of Jacob. It says the house of Jacob is the Jewish women. We are called Beit Yaakov. When God, before he gives the Torah to the Jewish people, it says to Moshe, speak to Beit Yaakov and talk to Bnei Yisrael. It's like, who's he talking about? It says, speak to the women and then speak to the men. And the women are called Beit Yaakov. We are that bayit. We are that place of kedusha, that place of holiness. So this Haftorah is reinforcing the idea about the sanctity of the family. Jacob's family is almost totally complete now. With the birth of Benjamin, it will be completely complete. But he shows Esau, he's like, you want to see what the power is of the Jewish people? This is where it comes, is from our homes. Our holiday of Hanukkah is coming, and talk about the time of year when we are bombarded with the Edomite, with the Esav message. Edom is considered the Roman Empire, the Christianity. That's one thing coming back from Israel at this time of year, like at the end of the year, is just like always like in your face about what is what we live in. And nobody's saying it's bad. I'm at Macy's and they're playing Christmas music and I'm going up the escalator and I start humming Silent Night, you know? The dust gets in your eyes. Like it just comes in your pores. It's very hard to kind of clean up and say, nice song, this is not me. Nice lights, it's not me. Nice party, it's not me, it's not mine. I'm sorry?
Eggnog.
Okay, have it at your, it's a good drink. Okay, I'm not sure rye eggs is maybe not to be so good for you either. So this whole time of year is a perfect opportunity for us to see who we are and make the statement about who we are dedicating ourselves to be. Mi chamocha ba'elim Adonai. Who is like God? Are you a Maccabee? Are you a Hellenist? What's it going to be? When we light our menorah, we're making a statement of where we're casting our vote. God willing, that vote represents what we truly feel and what our true aspiration and inspiration is designed to be. Our hope is that Hanukkah, that the light will illuminate us, because we need light to see through the darkness. It's just a lot out there that gets very confusing, and we're trying to find our way. In the end, we will be blessed and we will prevail. But there's a lot of time between now and then, and we want to be amongst the people who are the ones who see the light, have the light, benefit from the light, and can really experience the true miracle of, in our times. Have a wonderful Shabbos, a happy Hanukkah, a happy secular New Year. See you in 2015 on January 8th. Thank you. Yes, most of the Christmas songs are written by Jews. The White Christmas musical movie written by Jews, and it's Jews who are not sure who they really want to be and think that maybe they will be happier if they could just have a little bit of that dust in their face and be able to be Hellenists as well. It's like...
Yeah.